everybody, and welcome to Conversations with Lulu's first live episode. I'm super excited about this. In the spirit of adapting to the new coronavirus restrictions and for me to be able to make these conversations more natural, more timely and fun, I've decided to try this new format. For this first live episode, I'm joined by Rayan Karaki. He's the partners and platforms lead at Google. He's honestly such a maverick for agreeing to be my first victim for the live session. So really, I have to thank Ryan for agreeing to this. Sorry, Rayan. Before we start, just a quick note to thank our sponsor. It's JoyGifts. JoyGifts is a gifting marketplace operating in 22 cities across MENA, like Dubai, Riyadh, Jeddah, Beirut, and Cairo, and more. You can download their app or you can visit their website. It's JoyGifts, which is J-O-I, gifts.com. And you can order anything from flowers and sweets and balloons and other stuff. You can get a 15% discount on everything by using the promo code LULU15. That's LOULOU15. So thank you very much to Joy Gifts. And now, Rayan, welcome. And thank you so much for agreeing to do this.
Thanks, Lulu. Thanks for calling me a maverick. Well, you actually mean a guinea pig, but yeah, sure.
Well, I'm putting a lipstick on a pig. Let's put it this way.
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely.
So just a quick intro, just to give the listeners some context. Rayan, I have a colleague who's called Ryan, so I'm going to keep mixing it up. My apologies, Rayan. Rayan is okay. One of the brightest brains in digital, if not in general. He's also a ton of fun. I had the opportunity to meet him recently over a Christmas dinner. And while we talked about digital and startups and other bits and pieces, I got to know his funny side, and I got to know that he was a startup comedian, which was really fascinating because I think it takes a lot of guts to do that. So now you're in sitting at home in lockdown, and so how is that working for you?
Well, you can't really do stand-up comedy from where I sit, because most of my stand-up comedy style is story-based, you know. And now I kind of have to move over and let the generation of memes and one-liners and cheap comedy take over, and I just have to enjoy them like everyone else.
What a loss!
But at least actually it gives me a lot of time to write, because you observe people's behavior, and so I'm taking the time to write new material. Hopefully, in a post-COVID world, I'll get to perform a little bit.
Okay, so what kind of comedy? What kind of stand-up do you do?
So mostly I tell stories about childhood and growing up in Lebanon. Obviously, you know, growing up during the war comes with a lot of funny stories. So yeah, I'm not about to crack one now, if that's what you're looking for. That's the style.
What's the saying about public speaking?
I think Jerry Seinfeld said that the number one fear in human beings is speaking in public. And the number two is death.
Is death, yeah.
So in most funeral, yes, in most funeral, people would rather be in the casket than doing the eulogy, which is pretty funny.
So do you have any like is there a strategy to it? Are there any tips that are transferable potentially to work? You know, I'm sure it helps you in public speaking.
Are you gonna get into it if I give you some advice?
I don't know. Maybe I need to see if I've got it in me. I mean, I've been trying a lot of things recently, so who knows?
Good. I mean, look, the typical stuff, right? It's funny because, like, doing stand-up comedy and speaking in public or presenting have a lot of similarities. You know, like, best jokes have three punchlines. You know, everything good comes in threes.
Okay.
And you start from the least punchy to the highest punchy, and you have to start really strong and end really strong, because in the middle you can tell stories and people will tolerate them. But if you start strong, you'll get the hook, and if you finish strong, people will remember you for your last joke. So,
interesting.
You know, as if you're presenting.
Interesting. So it's quite transferable actually to everything you do at work and in life, probably. That's cool. So where do you get the creativity?
From everyday life, actually. I mean, just noticing how people behave, observing my life, and also being able to make fun of yourself is the number one rule, because the minute you make fun of yourself, people will start accepting you making fun of them.
Does it threaten you in any way? I mean, you are quite senior, in the corporate world.
Yeah.
Do you feel at all? I mean, I guess I would assume that maybe people don't do much public speaking because they're afraid to be ridiculed or made fun of. Does it scare you at all?
It doesn't scare me, but I try to keep these two worlds separate. It's very hard in a place like Dubai because, you know, your audience is your audience. And the minute someone knows you do stand-up comedy, they all want to come to your show. But yeah, it's a very, you have to navigate those there's a very fine line on what jokes I would say if I have colleagues in the room or what jokes I wouldn't say. So for example, I was asked multiple times to do a show for my colleagues only. And I said no, because some of the material is sensitive and it'll be frowned upon. Let's just say that.
I think this is amazing. Like I'd love to be able to do that. I think it's super gutsy from you. And I think the sort of message that I get out of it is, you know, it's okay. Even if you're like a senior corporate guy, it's okay to have fun and make fun of yourself. And as you said, you know, look at your life and tell jokes and funny stories, and it's totally fine. So
you can also, it transitions into the way you also lead and manage people and work with people, you know, what kind of rapport you build with them. If people feel like you can be vulnerable, then it's a different ballgame.
That's very interesting. So you're switching a little bit to your professional life, and so you were one of the earliest people in digital. Please take us through your story a little bit, and how did you stumble upon digital? Were you, you know, a visionary? Did you see it coming, or how? What's the story there?
No, to be honest, it was pure luck, and then I started really believing in it. I'm a finance graduate. I have nothing to do with digital advertising. I went into advertising because that was the job that was available back then, and I started with TV and print planning. That was my first job. Then I remember once in maybe 2004, early days, some guy who used to represent Yahoo in the region came to my office and pitched me that I should expand my Marriott campaign into something called banners and impression, and click-through was the metric back then. And we started running that campaign. And then 2 weeks into the campaign, he called me and he was like, you know what? This banner looks like it's international. Why don't you just add to it the Saudi Afakat, which is for Saudi only in Arabic. So we added that. And then suddenly the results doubled. And then I started getting curious, like, you know, you can actually do that. You can actually influence the way advertising results come back. And that's how I started getting into it. So it was purely luck. It was purely one display campaign. I think the whole campaign was like $1,500 and got us millions and millions of impressions back then.
Because that was in 2004,
that's,
you said.
It was 2004. It started very, very slow. Then in 2007, 2008, I went to the US with Publicis, with Starcom at the time. And I learned everything I need to learn about digital because it was already an advanced practice there. And I brought all the learnings and started what was back then Starcom IP, which is the digital arm of Publicis. And the journey started from there. I was doing this as a 20%, 30% job. And eventually it turned into like a 80, 90 team, people in my team across the MENA region, tackling all sorts of digital campaigns. All the way to 2014 when I was, you know, when I moved to Google.
So how was that? I mean, from what I've learned is you were quite an entrepreneur basically within the structure of Publicis. That basically you really took ownership of their digital arm and you grew it, and so you had a lot of autonomy at the time. How was that, you know, to work within the framework of a company?
So I wouldn't dare call myself an entrepreneur because I don't have the guts yet to to quit the corporate life and go do my own thing. Maybe an entrepreneur, yeah. So look, I think it started initially with no one caring about digital because it was such a small piece of the business. And, you know, I was left to kind of play alone in that space. I think the minute it started growing and getting a lot of attention from customers as well as internally, it became the hotcake, and everyone wants a piece of the hotcake.
When did that switch happen?
Funny enough, the crash in 2008 accelerated that. So I used to do the digital job as a part-time job before 2008. After the crisis, it became my full-time job, and we started hiring like crazy because I think what happened in that crisis is the accountability went up. And customers started expecting a lot more explanation on the return on investment that they make in media, and that's when digital took a strong position. Unfortunately, digital took a strong position in branding first. Performance is still a laggard in my view, but at least it was there. And then within that, you know, we launched a content practice. We launched a social practice. We actually started the first agency trading desk in MENA. And I think it was all based on one obsession that I had, which is that I didn't want to report it to EMEA. I wanted to report it to the US. And for me to report it to the US, I had to show that I'm actually capable of taking the most advanced stuff and try to implement it here. And some of my friends who were colleagues back then suffer from this until the day.
What's an agency trading desk? Just to clarify to everybody.
So if you heard of programmatic advertising,
yes. The platform that takes
data and puts and cooks data in the system to select the best inventory for that campaign is called a demand side platform, which is a tool that allows you to buy advertising programmatically. And as we move more towards automation now, I think not that I want to jump talk about COVID, but I think post COVID automation is going to take a much bigger priority even. And you know, the job of buying and running media campaigns, which is a commodity now, needs to be much more automated. So this process started for us in 2009, and we're probably agencies are going to reap the benefit in 2020. So
interesting. Even though you said something that you feel that buying media is a commodity.
Yeah, because automating the process of media will leave the agencies to do much more strategic work and. You know, much more thinking around what infrastructure customers have, what data is being utilized. So really do the strategic work that we were set out to do rather than waste, 70% of our time on the mediocre job of running campaigns.
And what kind of, I mean, if you grew the team, you said up to 80 or up to 90 people almost within a few years. So how was that? Do you have any tips on scaling quite quickly, on hiring? Were you able to find the right talent? Was there any conflict internally within the company that all of a sudden you're the star and you're growing this thing massively? So how was that period for you?
So you're gonna take me back to my anxious days.
Am I? Okay.
So look, to be completely transparent, just like today, there's definitely a battle between, back then it was battle between offline and online. Now it's the battle between automation and non-automation. And it's a battle between what is data analytics and what is everything that sits on top, what is client servicing. And I think back then it was, the key was to make sure that the revenue is still coming and to make sure that we diversify from the old way of making money, which is purely commission based on advertising spend. And I think back then we had also a very maverick CEO who globally, who actually pushed us to diversify the revenue sources, which allowed us to make all these investments. The internal battles, I won't comment too much on them. They were definitely there. They were there in the sense of how do we integrate the businesses, which is a fair ask. But then you can't take
like a totally separate business?
Practically, yes. Knowledge-wise, we were. Because, you know, you either have the knowledge on digital or you don't.
Yeah? Okay.
And because we were operating in a structure that services the whole agency, we became, you know, what you depend on for your life, because the customer is asking for digital, not because someone is asking him to do that. He's coming to a director on an account who doesn't know much about digital, who has to go to these specialist units to get that knowledge. And the key challenge became, how do you disseminate that knowledge across the agency? And that's a very, very tough choice. So
were you,
my opinion back then, obviously.
Were you given a like a share of voice per se, like when it came to media planning and so on, or you had to have that fight as well?
No, to be fair, I think pretty early on people understood the value. And I think the fact that we operated like a cost center, not like a profit center, allowed people to use our services, because also our services had higher margins. You know, digital was the new thing and it required specialized services, specialized skills, which means customers were willing to pay for those specialized skills a bit more than classical media.
And were you able to find the talent?
I think the Middle East region still struggles when it comes to talent. But I think it's mostly because advertising as an industry was not able to attract the right talent, because it couldn't compete with, let's say, management consultants, you know, and it couldn't compete with high paying jobs. And now it can't compete with tech, which is also a big challenge for that industry. And I think, look, if you look at the advertising spend per capita in MENA, it's been between $15 and $20 for the past 10 years, or even more, 20 years. That's compared to like $500 in the US, $600 in the US.
This is today.
$400 in the UK. This is today.
Wow.
Now, I know we're an oil-based you know, region, so not necessarily manufacturing, and therefore advertising didn't necessarily grow as much. But also, if you look at the purchasing power pre-COVID, we have some of the highest purchasing power in some of the countries that we are, and the neighboring countries. So it just doesn't make sense. And that's been always my obsession, which is, how do we make sure we increase that? How do we make sure we increase that? But that money never came. And I think the lack of the right investment at the right time, we waited for 2008 crisis for digital to become an important channel. And now we waited for a 2020 crisis for infrastructure to become the right play. So it seems like we like to wait for the crisis and then leapfrog all what we've missed on for a long time, hopefully.
Yeah, we have to do it in spite of us, not proactively, reactively. So is it that, yeah. why is that number so high in the US? Is it because most of the spend is done by small businesses, whereas, for example, here you have maybe the big multinational spending with the agencies? Or what's the reason?
Yeah, I think it's multiple reasons. I think the understanding of the importance of advertising is much more mature in a lot of other markets. So, for example, take pharma. Pharma is a huge industry globally. You don't see pharma advertising in the region, right? Insurance, banking, finance, all the it doesn't really happen. The other thing is the how the media is formed. So if you look at MENA before digital, mediums used to be a regional medium. So TV used to be a satellite TV that covers multiple regions. And it used to be expensive relative to the fact that if I want to advertise today only for people who are sitting in one area of the Arab world, I didn't have that many options besides newspapers, right? Or radio, local radio. I didn't have a very strong medium like TV. Versus in the US, you know, you have local news, you have local channels, you have regional channels, and then you have nationwide channels. And they have different viewerships. And with that different viewerships come different pricing. So even the nature of the media also allowed for that. The second thing is that I still think digital advertising is still underrepresented and undersold, because technically it should be, anyone should be able to advertise. Before COVID, I used to talk about hotels, right? Why should I still go on booking.com, check the hotel, and that's it? Why can't I handpick the room that I want to be in exactly after I've seen all of it? So why isn't this advertising present on YouTube? Why should banks digitize their product but not advertise their product digitally? Like, it's a bit counterintuitive. So I think these three factors is what slowed us down dramatically.
Interesting. So since obviously we're talking about platforms, let's talk a little bit about Google, your new role. So you switched in 2014, you said, so it's not exactly new, been a while. What's your role exactly, and how could someone listening, like, can you benefit the average business, or do you work with specific partners only?
So I'll just take you through the transition of roles that I played at Google, because they're a bit different from each other. I moved to Google with the initial goal of helping us establish the right relationship with agencies and the right business model and commercial deals based on the way agencies are commercially structured. Also to help agencies, you know, get a grip on our product, because our product is dynamic and changes a lot. Then I moved to the DoubleClick side at the time, which is now a Google Marketing Platform, which is focused again on programmatic. So it's funny, because my boss back then was the same person who sold me the platforms in 2009, as I was telling you earlier, the programmatic platform. So then I moved to manage kind of all the partnerships at Google, along with our product specialism. So on the partnerships, I think if we're really going to make that change, which was what I was telling you about, which is the spend per capita in MENA, we can't solely rely on one type of partner, because we can't solely rely on CMOs driving that agenda. I think CEOs need to shift the perception that advertising is an expense versus an investment. And we need the CFOs to build the right financial model to understand what return on that investment is going to be meaningful enough for that advertising line not to be scratched off every time we are in crisis, which tends to happen all the time. So that's my observation. With that, we need different types of partners. We need partners who can consult. So the typical consultancies that you see, which historically would address the build or the IT part of the infrastructure, but wouldn't touch marketing per se. We need system integrators, so people who can actually take the customer's technology and plug it with our technology or with CRM or with any technology that is needed.
Can you give some examples, maybe just for it to be a bit clear? Can you name a few partners, for example, or companies that you work with, just for me to understand, or you can't?
I would rather not, because the others are going to be pissed off. But I'll give you an example of something that we've done. Not necessarily in this region, but for a similar role in other regions. So we've worked with a European airline, for example, on, instead of still assigning a budget from point A to point B for that airline, why aren't we using load factor, price per ticket, profitability as the indication on where we should buy advertising and with what messaging? Does that make sense? So for that to happen, there's a lot of steps that need to happen before that people usually miss out on. There needs to be the right infrastructure that connects business data before we even start talking about audience data. Then you need the right marketing technology that captures the right audience data. Then you need advertising technology that allows you to buy this in an automated way at scale.
Okay.
So these steps, which I call digital marketing maturity, is what we try to achieve, but it's possible for Google to achieve all these aspects because we don't play in every aspect of those. That's why consultancies play a big role and system integrators play a big role. And then comes the media agencies.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Are the media agencies filling this gap to a certain extent?
Yeah, so media agencies play now in the ad tech space and martech space. They're getting more and more involved in that aspect, while at the same time, there's a convergence happening from the consultancies on getting more and more into media buying and planning. So they're kind of meeting in the middle right now, which is good for the ecosystem, but also it shows that this change needs to happen quickly on both sides. So the conversations we have with both of them is very different, but eventually leads to the same bottom line. And interesting enough is in a lot of parts of Europe, we're seeing agencies and consultancies come in and work together on certain client businesses. So they leverage each other's knowledge to be able to drive that journey for the customer in terms of maturity, which is I think if we are able to drop our egos a bit, and I put myself, when I was in the agency, I would go, never, no way, I would work with a consultant. you know, if we actually start thinking beyond, and COVID is going to force us to do that, if we think beyond that, then actually we'll be able to get somewhere.
Interesting. So let's speak a little bit, let's talk a little bit about COVID. I was on a call actually earlier today. We're doing a panel next week on the future of work, and someone on the panel who's a researcher, basically she was saying that in the previous pandemics that happened, it took around 3 years for people to recover basically and come back to a new normal. I speak to my friends. I think everyone's pretty optimistic. Everyone feels that, in a couple of months, we'll be back to normal. Google recently announced that you're going to work, you have the option to work from home, I think, up until next year. So where do you sit on that debate? Are you do you think it's a couple of months, or do you think this is the type of change that's going to just make it like a seismic shift and life is going to change?
Look, whatever I tell you, I'll be literally crystal balling it. So I'll be like literally coming up with my own theory. But what I care about is the long lasting impact of COVID. Okay. And that is undeniable. Okay. Meaning? I think a lot of businesses were caught off guard on their readiness to work from home. Right. What we used to see as a perk in the tech companies, the Facebooks, the Amazon, the Googles, that they work from home, oh, how fun it is. Actually, it proved now that whether it's on purpose or not, I'm not sure, that it was one of the wisest decisions ever, because it allowed us to get into the new normal in a very, very fast way, while a lot of other businesses struggled to do that.
Actually, on that, most startups, anyway, I come from the startup world, and in the time when for example, our engineering team, they were all sitting in Greece and Athens, so remote work was something very normal and natural.
Exactly.
Exactly. You're right, tech I think is quite familiar with this way of work.
So that's one that's undeniable, is that everyone needs to be ready for this to happen again. Whether it's going to happen again or not is irrelevant. The second thing is, how is consumer behavior going to change? And I think people tend to jump to conclusions really quickly. So I heard
answers.
A lot of stories about
people
a lot
don't
of
like ambiguity. I think in general they want someone to tell them.
Yeah, but they need to put their finger on the pulse, right? There's a lot of data today and a lot of insights that are being pulled by all tech companies, not just Google, on what is the consumer asking for. And I don't know. I mean, I'll give you an example. If I take automotive as an industry, right? The initial thought was, okay, oil prices are tanking. No one's going to need oil anymore because people are not going to want to drive to work and not going to want to commute. People are not going to want to buy cars, right? That's the initial assumption. But then actually what we figured is across EMEA and APAC and the US, people who used to use public transportation are actually moving away from that. And we've seen a 30% jump and people inquiring about purchasing a car and making the decision at home. So now, are they going to buy the Aston Martin? Probably not. Okay, but how does that guide the automotive industry? What choices does the automotive industry have to make to provide people with the experience that they had in a showroom, but digitally? I think the same thing applies to multiple industries. You can pick any industry you want.
Education. And if they don't have their education,
so I think I think right now education we're struggling to understand that. First of all, we left teachers in the dark ages for a long time because schools are overpaid, teachers are underpaid, so we didn't allow the teachers to kind of move with the progress, at least in our region. I don't think we have online education yet. I think we have an adaptation of some Zoom sessions to try to get the kids not to be completely ignorant. Honestly,
I have kids and honestly, from my experience, these online tools are the most horrible tools you can ever use. There's zero user experience. That's not online learning. This is not online learning. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And
but why are we guessing? Like, do we have e-learning today that's available. And if you want to learn something today, are the options out there?
Of course.
They are, right? As an adult.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they kind of build what a syllabus looks like. Some of the big universities as well have done that. So why are we trying to recreate it? Why aren't we just learning from that experience? And, you know, bring in also the child psychologist experts, and then find a way to you know, balance the parents' time with the teacher's time. You know, like I feel, but it's okay, because this came as a surprise to everyone. It didn't happen over, well, the regression of our education system has been happening for the past 50 years. But
the regression.
But right now this came as a surprise, and I think, like everyone, they're going to have to adapt. Yeah, but I also think, like, some industries, people think like, oh, this industry is going to win. I'm not also so sure. If I take retail as an example, it's a very, very tough play. So
I
have tons
article,
of opinions about it, but we can get that to everyone. Yeah.
There was a Bloomberg article this morning that I read, basically, that says a lot of shopping now is happening. Oh, there's a new trend that is happening, which is live stream. So you have these influencers live streaming products. It's kind of like the TV shopping, you know. It's they're kind of like bringing back that that industry to life. But you know what? Like, if you think about the future of work, by the way, I mean, these are like new jobs, quote unquote, that are being created. Your people are, you know, through digital, becoming their own brands. They're building their own brands. And we all know that, you know, when it comes to shopping, a referral is definitely goes, you know, a long way versus an ad. So is this, what are your thoughts on this? Apparently it's happening in China a lot.
Yeah, I think the difference is in China, you know, if you've been to China lately, or you've ever been to China before all of this, everything is already digitized, right? WeChat was like the gateway to everything. So I think it's slightly different here. You know, there's still a whole generation that we have to teach how to use online first, right? We have 200 million users in the Arab world who are still to be connected. There's two worlds.
I'm surprised by the stats, actually, because every stat that I read is that how we all have our smartphones, how we have as a region one of the highest growth when it comes to internet penetration.
You're thinking GCC. That's the reality.
But the growth is also across MENA, no? I'm thinking GCC when it comes to smartphones, but when it comes to internet.
Even if you look at penetration, it's very high here. But if you start going into North Africa, you know, where are we? We still have 200 million people to connect. And what's going to be their gateway? And how are we going to bring them into the process of online online emailing before shopping to begin with? That's one side.
Surprised by this, actually. I mean, my mother is 70 and she has a Facebook account.
Well, my mother is 75 and I had to teach her how to buy groceries online. So, on very not intuitive user experience apps. I won't name them, but you know, that's another thing that also is hampering the growth. So you're mentioning influencers and their ability
If you're a small business, if you're a small business today, what can you do today? I mean, you said it's $15, spend basically on digital ads here versus $600 or $500 in the US. So
not on digital ads, on total ads.
Total ads. Sorry. Okay. I'm glad you clarified. Okay, so what do I need to do as a small business today?
Okay, so we can have the dreamy answer and we can have the realistic answer.
The realistic answer says
that first thing you need to do is you need to understand how much can you sustain your business with the current environment, because we don't know if this is going to continue or if this doesn't continue, if it's going to come back. So you need to understand what longevity of the business you actually have. Second thing is, if you rush to a decision now, just because you're running after the money, more likely than not, these decisions are not going to be sustainable. So I'll give you an example. We saw a lot of apps, I want to name them, pivot towards groceries, right?
Yes,
as a means to address. Sure. So let's examine that phenomenon. So the easiest thing, yes, on the short term, great. Cost of acquisition is really low. Everybody wants to shop for groceries online. The choices are limited, right? But post-COVID, when things return to quasi-normal a little bit, okay, even if this continues, the size of the basket or the shopping cart is going to be smaller because people are not going to be trying to hoard stuff like crazy. And the amount of players in that space are going to be many. So I just don't see how, on the long term, that's sustainable or profitable.
Well, there could
if they're doing this as a plug gap.
There could be mergers and acquisitions. There could be some that
exactly.
buy. I mean, I was having a chat as well with Philip Bahoshi recently, who's the founder of Magnet, and which is a startup data platform. And he was saying, I mean, he was predicting that, you know, we're gonna see a lot of death of startups or failures, let's say, in this part of the world. And that was, I had the discussion with him before COVID. So I'm sure we're gonna see.
Interesting.
You know, quite a bit of maybe mergers and acquisitions and failures, but that's startups.
Perfect. So, but even within the SMEs, why is it different? So if you today understand the longevity of the business, and you know that realistically your chances to survive are very low, you need to start relying on who are the other companies or partners that I can work with or that I can merge with, you know, to be able to sustain the business. Because the last thing you want is to go, I don't care how long I can still run. I'm going to run after the money. I'm going to establish a model that's quick and fits the short term. And then on the long run, as you said, you end up with, you know,
yeah,
with nothing.
I mean, I guess what you're trying to say is, you know, don't make rash decisions and don't make decisions.
So that's one. Two is keep your finger on the pulse.
Yeah.
You know, understand what consumers are looking for.
I really like what you said, you know, that we, like, people are jumping to conclusion, and it's true. And mm-hmm. and you see it, you know, when is it there going to be a vaccine? When are we going to come out of this? When are we going to be able to fly again or go on vacation or whatever? And I think people just want to know. And you're right. It's, I think, dangerous to jump to conclusions early on. So. I'm just conscious of time, so I think I'm going to try to wrap up a little bit. What do you think is the... So let's take today, okay, with COVID and post-COVID. Realistically, what do you think is the biggest opportunity in the region that's gonna come out of this? Do you think that... what's missing? What's lagging? What do you feel that is going to be... a sector that's going to grow or be interesting, or maybe even a behavioral trend that's going to come out of this? Like, is there an opportunity for this region?
Look, I think the one thing that I didn't mention in all of this is what COVID has done to people is that it's true, it isolated us in our homes, but it actually rebuilt that sense of community. And if today you look at what is being consumed online, there's a lot of content that's being pushed that's related to things at home. Yeah. So work out with me, cook with me. And it's actually building communities around those, you know, those, if you want, activity. And at the same time, from a consumption perspective as well, we're seeing a lot of consumption of video on demand and a lot of consumption on video happening on the TV screen. We've actually seen like a 30% jump on average of consumption of, let's say, YouTube on a TV screen, which wasn't happening before, and that will stick. So I think there is definitely an opportunity for people to become brands, as you mentioned earlier. It's just that they're going to have to be able to keep up with the changes that the consumer is expecting. The same thing applies for business, you know. So if I'm an automotive customer, how am I going to give the experience of being in a store while being at home? So I think the difference with doing something at home and doing something in the store is that in one, it's purely transactional. The other is the full experience. Are these words going to come together, and how do you actually bring them together, especially if you're in a startup space? That's I think, the equation that's the holy grail for the coming couple of years.
So there
and
is
I'd be
a
very, very
role
interested to see.
for entrepreneurs, obviously, to plug these gaps as well.
Oh, absolutely. How many startups came up of the 2008 crisis? Uber, I think Shopify. So there's multiple, Slack actually, not Shopify. But,
Airbnb.
Airbnb.
But going back to just one point on the people becoming brands, I mean, if you are in mature markets, you're able to make millions of dollars and revenue, for example, from YouTube. I mean, we hear these stories every once in a while about a kid that's making like $20 million. I'm like, oh my God, I'm in the wrong goddamn business. So how do you, I mean, are these opportunities there in here? Can you make that much money off YouTube?
So I want to comment about making money off YouTube because, you know,
okay.
First of all, it's not my expertise. And even if I know a little bit about it, I don't want to talk about it. But, why not? Why not?
Okay.
I don't, you know, I think we have the talent in the region. I think actually we proved we have the talent. We just need the talent that actually brings real value. And I think that's the area that I feel that I would, you know, I would double down on is instead of focusing mostly on how can we extract money of the influencers, if you want to call them, or the creators, is first, how can we support the creators to create the right content?
What do you mean extract money?
So,
who's extracting money? Like, you mean, as in, give me an example.
I'll give you an example. If a brand today decides to use an influencer or a creator, they use them in a very commercial method. It's a one-off and it's gone.
Okay.
Right? Rarely do we see a long-term relationship that is really focused on getting the best content out of that creator to entertain the audience and at the same time benefit on the long term. We don't see these investments.
Interesting.
You know, if you look at, not to compare Michael Jordan to any influencer, but if you look at how Michael Jordan signed with Nike, if you're watching the Netflix documentary, if you're not, please watch it. They're two brands that grew together. Obviously, Jordan brought a lot more benefit to Nike, but now I think it's vice versa. So I feel like there's not enough investment that's going into creators and influencers to really get them to focus on doing something that's meaningful for the region, so we can actually start exporting the PewDiePies and the people you mentioned that are making tons of money.
I have an answer here. Who's the greatest of all time? Is it Kobe Bryant or MJ?
No, I think MJ, but Kobe modeled the game after him. Thanks for that.
So Ryan, is there one thing you'd wish we would stop doing in this part of the world, or we start doing in general?
Yeah, I wish we'd stop running after the short term. Actually, COVID gives us a big opportunity to do that, because now we can really focus on what is the right play that's going to have impact in a year. And I think with businesses, like in my time at agencies, I think this is the perfect opportunity. Because if you're a big company and you're publicly traded, the pressure right now is high, but how much incremental can it come if you make 1 or 2 million less? So do the right investment now, so in a couple of years you can actually benefit out of it. I think government and private sector needs to continue supporting SMEs, because they're actually the wheel of the economy. And I think entrepreneurs, I'm putting a big bet on them, and hopefully one day soon I'll join them.
Yeah, I was going to say,
because I think they're the ones who are frugal enough and understand how to really spend every penny. If I was to start a company today, I would hire purely entrepreneurs if they choose to come with me.
I think, you know, we need and I'm saying we as someone who's been an entrepreneur for quite some time and in the space. I think, you know, we really need people that are well experienced in the corporate world and come in with basically a lot of experience and a lot of depth. But it's so difficult to convince people like your caliber, you know, to leave their awesome jobs and jump in and eat tuna cans and noodles.
Well, there are other ways to do it, right? I mean, hopefully one day I will make the jump, and I promise myself that I will. I sit on the board of two different startups, and you know, I can contribute as much as I can. So I don't see why I can't help others. And I'm happy to mentor if needed. And I'm sure a lot of other Googlers and other tech companies as well are happy to mentor.
That's cool. I mean, you're still in your 20s, so you've got a long time.
Exactly. Exactly. I need a mentor myself. Thanks, Lulu.
All right. So I'm gonna let you off the hook in terms of not saying a joke. But Ryan has got an interesting Instagram account called the Skinny Arab. So you can see some of his jokes. Yeah, of course. Hopefully one day I'll be able to see you in person. I think that'll be very interesting. To wrap up, I just want to thank everybody that tuned in on LinkedIn. I want to thank everybody who's made some comments. We'll try to figure out a way to be able to get people to engage and ask questions and hopefully give some time for Q&A as well. So really, thank you to everybody. This is the first time I'm doing this live. So hopefully it's the beginning of something. I just want to make a final self-promotion note. So please, if you haven't done so, check out Conversations with Lulu on any of the podcasting apps or on YouTube as well, if you'd like to see the video format. And until the next episode, stay safe. Have a good evening, Ryan, and thank you very much for your time.
Awesome. You too.
All right.
Thank you for having me.
Take care. Bye.
Cheers. Bye.
See you.
Bye.